We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Welcome to Focus 580. This is Carol Spindell sitting in for David Inge. Our guest today is Cheryl Wudunn. She is the author, along with her husband, New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof, of a new book called Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide. Half the Sky is the third book Wudunn and Kristof have written together, and they are the only married couple to have received a Pulitzer Prize for their collaborative reporting. Half the Sky is a labor of love and conviction. In it, Kristof and Wudunn advocate for the emancipation and empowerment of women in the developing world. If slavery was the moral challenge of the 19th century and the battle against totalitarianism the moral challenge of the 20th century, they stake out the idea in this book that gender equality in the developing world is the moral challenge of our century. The book focuses on three areas: sex trafficking and forced prostitution, gender-based violence, including honor killings and mass rape, and maternal mortality. Before we begin our conversation today, I would like to caution listeners that these topics by necessity touch on sex and violence and might be inappropriate for younger listeners. And of course, if you're out there and would like to join our conversation, please do by calling 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Cheryl Wudunn, welcome to welcome to Focus 580.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Carol.
So glad you could join us. This book is based on years of in-depth reporting. You and your husband, Nick, sought out women in Afghanistan and Malawi and India. You go to red light districts and cities. You go to remote rural villages to document their stories. But in the beginning of the book, you say that for a long time, as a journalist, you didn't think of the abuses that women suffer daily as news. So what changed your mind?
Carol, it really was a process that evolved over the years. When we were in China covering Tiananmen Square, we were outraged by hundreds of students who were killed on the square, anywhere from 400 to 800. But that was all front page news. We were all outraged. However, the next year, as we started roaming the Chinese countryside and visiting a lot of these rural villages, we discovered another very amazing and outrageous fact. We had learned that about 39,000 Chinese female babies die every year before they reach the age of one, basically, because they were just never taken to the doctor. They were just let to die. And that wasn't getting a single column inch in any of our newspapers. So we were beginning to think that the way we cover news events was a little bit awry. These are things that happened to these baby girls, you know, on a daily basis every single year. So it wasn't a big single event where 39,000 babies were killed on one day. The hard part is for reporters is to cover something that is just, you know, beats in and out every single day. That alerted us to the larger problem, which we talk about in Half the Sky.
Obviously, there's a moral argument for gender equality. It's a human rights issue. It's the right thing to do. But a lot of this book also makes a pragmatic argument that this just makes a lot of economic sense. Many experts feel that educating girls is one of the most cost-effective investments we can make in the developing world. I mean, could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, it's exactly right. On the one hand, we do think this is the greatest moral challenge of our times. It's the cause of our times. But aside from the right and wrong of it all, on a purely practical level, it makes absolute sense to really try and rectify, to really address these challenges. And that's because one of the best ways, we think, of ending poverty and fighting terrorism is to educate girls and to empower women by bringing them into the formal labor force. Research does show that when you actually educate a girl and she goes through education all the way as high as possible to get a job and becomes a wage earner, she actually really spins herself into a virtuous cycle then out and not a vicious cycle. So she really gives back to not only her, her family, but also her village. She sends money back to the family. She might even create a business that takes off within the village. So she's contributing to her village-level economics, to her county-level economics, and basically to, on an aggregate level, to the national economy.
There are a lot of really hopeful stories in this book, but there are also some very shocking stories. And I have to say, the section that deals with trafficking and sex slavery, the sheer numbers of girls that are kidnapped and sold as sex slaves, and these girls often live in rural areas. They don't know. These traffickers promise them jobs as dishwashers in a restaurant, or they're going to sell fruit in a market. They want to help their families. The families are desperate. And they often end up locked up in brothels. They're very young.
Absolutely. And that's what really tears your heart out. I mean, that when you see a 13-year-old girl who has been forced into prostitution, it's very hard to walk away. And that's why we actually, as we started seeing all these cases, we felt we had to write this book, because it was something that was extremely horrific and, at the same time, something that could be easily addressed. And we do see these problems being solved. So in Half the Sky, we talk about two basically girls that were sold into sex slavery, and my husband, Nick Kristoff, actually bought them to free them. But, you know, we also discovered that things are not so easy. It's just not easy just to free someone. One of the girls that he did buy out of basically prison, was really delighted at first. We brought her back to the village, and she had a reunion with her family after not having seen them for 5 years. And she was all set to run a stall selling some goods right next to her mother. After, you know, Nick returned home after a few days, got a message back that, well, she returned to the brothel. It turned out that the brothel had actually built up an addiction in her to meth, and so she had to go back to get her fix. They do that sometimes to create a dependency. We finally were able to, in the long run, fix that situation, and we describe that in Half the Sky. But it isn't easy.
It isn't.
Helping people isn't easy.
It isn't, and you do. I think it gives credulity to the book that you do tell a number of stories that are disappointments, that don't all have happy endings, I have to say. Sometimes these women have children and they're held hostage in the brothel. You tell a remarkable story about a woman who keeps going back, and she escapes, but she keeps trying to get her children out.
Yes, actually, India is one place where it is very difficult to extract people out of an ecosystem, because what happens is that the brothels if you will, breed these girls. They actually get the girls pregnant so that their kids are grown up in the brothels, and then actually can be basically workers, you know, on an indentured basis within the brothel. But in the end, the story that Mina, who I think you're referring to,
yes.
Luckily it has a happy ending.
Long and arduous struggle, but eventually a happy ending. It's really a moving story of how she's finally reunited with her son. And
yes, yes, she does. I mean, in that story, she really was very courageous. She basically didn't want to leave the brothel because they did have her two kids there. She did escape and felt terrible, and then kept going back to try and see if she could sort of capture them. And one time her son found a way to get out, and he was able to find her only because he heard about one town that she might be in. And then they were reunited, which was fabulous, but then she still had her daughter there. And so they took a long time, but they finally were able to rescue the daughter as well.
Now, some people feel that the best way to improve women's lives is to legalize prostitution. Then it could be regulated. It could be safer, especially in the era of AIDS. And you say that you did used to agree with that approach, but you've changed your mind.
Absolutely. You know, we actually thought that at first legalization made sense because it took away some of the incentives. But we write about a project, the Sonogachi Project in India, where we just discovered it just doesn't, you know, legalization doesn't work. That was a very high-profile project where they did allow the prostitution under monitoring by the authorities. Well, it turns out that the monitoring wasn't really legitimate monitoring. Everyone seemed to sort of be in on the show. And, in fact, the rates of infection of AIDS, partly because they were supposed to use condoms. Since it was legal, they could actually go in there and teach everybody to use condoms. But, in fact, people weren't using condoms in any case. The patrons didn't want to use condoms. You know, the rates were maybe slightly, AIDS were slightly better, but in fact, they weren't really that significant. On the other hand, in another part of India, there was a case where they actually cracked down, no legalization. It was just a straight, you know, crackdown. And basically, they've wiped out, really decimated the brothels in that area. So we were really, we came to believe that a crackdown is ultimately the only thing that will actually eradicate this kind of prostitution.
If listeners are just joining us, I'm Carol Spindell, sitting in today for David Inge, and our guest is Cheryl Wudun. We're talking about the new book she's written with her husband, Nicholas Kristof. It's called Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide. And you're welcome to call and join our conversation, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. And yet, despite these efforts, sex trafficking has expanded in recent years.
Yes, it is something that really needs to be addressed, and it is terrible. I mean, it's something that really can be addressed with education in the long term, because a lot of the girls just simply don't know what they can do or what how to speak up for themselves. So education would really help them. And another thing is a crackdown. One of the most effective ways of dealing with some of this forced prostitution is what the State Department uses, called the TIP report. It's the Trafficking in Persons report. And it forces countries to actually show that they've made progress in combating trafficking, else they face possible sanctions from the U.S. It is one of the most effective things and a very low-cost way to address this problem. And we've seen the results in places like Malaysia and even, you know, in some parts of Cambodia.
So this is one case where Western nations do have a role to play and can play a positive role, and the results actually do trickle down to girls like those in your book.
Absolutely. The State Department actually can play a very big role, and so can the U.S. I mean, we don't always have to go in there, you know, taking a megaphone and telling people, okay, now stop the trafficking. But there are very many other ways that one can work with the governments using the possibility of sanctions to force them to address some of these issues, and it's not just trafficking.
Another issue in this very complex reality of how to empower girls is that they're taught in so many cultures to be docile, not to speak up, not to complain, not to defend themselves. And this makes them so vulnerable.
That's very true. And that's why education really is one of the best solvents. If you look at a place like Pakistan, for instance, you know, we've spent so much money there, most of it on the military, $10 billion, $11 billion there since 9/11. And if we had just devoted more money to education, maybe 2 or 3 cents of a dollar goes to education in those areas from this all this money that has been allocated there. If we'd spent a little bit more money, we'd be 8-9 years already down the road in terms of educating a new crop of girls and women.
There's one story in your book that is so remarkable. I don't know if you can tell a little bit of it, but this woman who, despite that culture, is absolutely fearless. Her name is
Mukhtar Mai.
Usha. I was thinking of Usha,
yes, okay.
Who, despite this culture of docility, she takes on a ferocious opponent and wins.
Absolutely. Usha was a remarkable woman. She came from an unusual family in the area, a small village in India, where her family was educated. Her parents respected education. So she was on a path to become a marketing expert for, you know, hotel industry. She really was very, very clever. And one time when she was back from school visiting her parents, she was talking to a neighbor. There is this big bully in her town. I mean, he is, you know, just not just the mafia. He is the mafia, the local mafia, who terrorized all the neighbors to the point where, I mean, not just beating them up, he was torturing the women in that village, throwing acid on them, just, you know, cutting them up, really, you know, not just beating them, just really killing them. He is responsible for a lot of the deaths of the women in that village. And then he actually attacked the neighbor. So the neighbor went to Usha and said, you know, what do I do? And she said, go report it to the authorities. Well, of course, the neighbor was, you know, petrified. Of course, I'm not going to report this to authorities. He'll kill me. And so Usha reported the neighbor, the attack on the neighbor to the authorities. Well, of course, the mafia found out, this guy, this tough, found out that it was Usha who did it. So he came over to Usha's house. She had locked the door, but he said, I've got some acid out here. If you don't come out right now, I'm gonna burn you up with the acid. You better stop what you're doing. And he was yelling at her, and then she actually yelled back. She said, I'm not coming out, and I'm turning on the gas right now, and if you do anything, I'm not only going to blow myself up, I'm going to blow you up. Well,
The story. They were at a standoff, but in the end, she won, didn't she?
Well, it was.
It's a long and upsetting story.
Yes, in the end, she does. She and the village women get together and conquer him. It was quite a stunning turnabout, and the end result was that the women in that village realized that they had some rights.
That's right. It took one person to stand up and say, I'm not going to back down. I'm not afraid. And although she's still paying a price.
Yes. She actually, didn't get to go into the marketing business in the hotel industry, but she now is the unofficial village mayor.
That's great. And she's trying to organize economic activity in her area.
Absolutely. She's rebuilding her village.
But I believe you said that when Nick went to visit her, none of the taxis would take him there and said, we don't know a woman by that name.
Exactly. And they were basically trying to protect her. So she really has become the unofficial leader of that village.
A wonderful story. All right. We have a caller calling on line one from Champaign. Hello.
Hi there. How are you? I do have a bit of a tangent, but I'll first applaud your work for bringing this up. It seems a shame in some ways that after all the meetings and the UN declarations of the Year of the Woman and Copenhagen and Beijing and everything, that things haven't been turned around as much as they should be. And I think there is a utilitarian argument that there won't be rural development until there's more equality for women. But my tangent, if I'm allowed, is... It bothers me when I see the justification for things like the humanitarian interventions, when they're as if the Pentagon is intervening for feminist reasons, it seems to me. And there's particularly I'm focused on Afghanistan, there's a new film out called Rethinking Afghanistan by Robert Greenwald that's just opening and being available. And has commentaries from women of Afghanistan, such as the Revolutionary Association Women of Afghanistan and Rawa and Sonali Kalhatar, who just don't buy it at all. I mean, the people that are in power now are almost as bad as any of the worst of the Taliban, Hekmatyar, who was, you know. Anyway, it is a digression, but it bothers me when I see this this kind of justification when it doesn't take much examination of the circumstance to see that isn't the motivation and that isn't even the fact of the situation there. So, but the main focus is that there can't be any kind of real development in a lot of areas in the world without equality for women. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for your call. Cheryl, do you want to address that? I know you do talk a lot about Afghanistan in the book.
Oh, yes. No, I mean, I think that basically if he's saying that it's not right to actually justify intervention there it seems as though we definitely do need to address the issue of inequality because that will actually help turn around the culture in the long run. I mean, the only way you really get a change in cultural attitudes, which is extremely necessary in a place like Afghanistan, is to educate people in a more enlightened way. And that education must extend to women because then you get a double dividend when you educate women. They end up having kids later on in life, and they tend to have fewer kids, and the fewer kids that they raise are done in a much smarter way, both boys and girls. They have to raise their boys just as smartly as they raise their girls.
You point out that better results often come, rather than Westerners coming in, spending millions of aid dollars, that often we get better results if we support local women leaders who understand the culture. They can operate more efficiently. They can operate more inexpensively. They know how to proceed. And this seems to be particularly true in Muslim countries like Afghanistan. Westerners with all the best intentions are apt to unintentionally offend.
Absolutely. When one talks about giving aid to foreign countries, that's just the first step. The second really critical step is how do you give that aid? And we don't advocate just throwing the money out and putting up a banner saying this is an American school. I mean, the key thing is to actually partner with local institutions. They know how to work on the ground the best, and they also know how to navigate the politics, how to navigate the authorities and any kind of obstacles that foreigners just wouldn't know how to get around. But what they do need from the West are resources, expertise, technological and also just soft expertise, know-how, as well as money.
Mm-hmm. You talk about Sakina Yakubi, an Afghan woman who has started an organization to educate women and did so at great risk, I believe, under the Taliban.
Absolutely. Sakina is an amazing woman. Here she is, a Afghan woman who has built up a network of 100-plus schools. I mean, she's actually built it on a school-by-school basis, schools that focus on educating girls. And this is in Afghanistan, the one area that is so opposed and so sort of stringently looks down on women. So here she has been very successful. At the same time that other foreigners who have come in to try and build schools to educate women have not been. So the key here is that you really do have to work with local organizations who know how to navigate.
And her schools do teach Islam and teach religion, but they focus on moderate passages in the Quran so that women are aware of those passages. They can direct their husbands to those passages. They can use those to navigate society and perhaps change society.
Absolutely. I mean, the key there is that she's educating women just to learn how to fight for themselves, to stand up for themselves. So it is not only educating them about the Quran and what the Quran says and what it does not say. I mean, the Quran does not specifically say, look down on women, beat your wife. I mean, that's a lot of that is not religion per se. It's the culture that has been built around the religion. And she teaches them that. And she also gives them skills, which are critically important for them to enter the workforce. And that's one of the keys, is that the women can't just survive on education alone. They need to be able to work.
It is true, though, that more girls than boys drop out of school. And you talk about some very simple, inexpensive, pragmatic ways to keep girls in school. And I think we ought to talk about those just so that people are aware of how, kind of nitty-gritty some of these and simple some of these things might be, like the reality of intestinal worms.
Yes, yes. It's not the sexiest of programs, but a deworming program would be extremely successful in trying to keep girls in school. Part of the problem in a lot of these developing countries is that, you know, when you get sick, you don't want to go to school. And with worms, you also can't focus your attention. Basically, the worms sort of eat at you so that you actually, you know, you can't sit still, you can't focus very well. So if you actually set up a program in a lot of these schools to deworm the kids, this would have a benefit not only for the girls but also for the boys. I mean, it's just got a gender-wide benefit, but especially girls, because they're much more prone and vulnerable to being pulled out of school, you could really keep them in school for a lot longer. Another kind of program is, you know, providing lunches. You know, mm-hmm. it's so cheap for Westerners to help schools in these developing areas to provide lunches, which actually are real motivation for kids to go to school.
And you also talked about something as simple as iodized salt.
Yes, iodized salt.
Again, not a very sexy program.
Exactly. That's one of the problems, is that these programs, because they're not sexy, they don't always, you know, jump to the top of the agenda. But iodine is a critically important ingredient to have for just your level of IQ. If we actually were to give iodine to a lot of pregnant mothers, you know, they would actually bear kids who would stay in school, because lack of iodine, we don't really appreciate this fact, but a lack of iodine not only leads to goiter, which most of us in the West are more familiar with, but it also actually takes away 10 to 15 IQ points in a fetus.
Mm.
And so girls are starting out way behind, you know, when they just don't even have the, you know, level of average IQ. So if we can iodize the salt or give iodine tablets to pregnant mothers, they'd be off on a better footing.
And so easily preventable. I mean, that's the tragedy of some of these things. It doesn't take some expertise that we don't have. It doesn't take some huge technical apparatus that has to be taken into sub-Saharan Africa. I mean, something so simple as iodized salt tablets.
Absolutely. You know, this is not trying to invent the next smallpox vaccine. This is something totally within our current science.
What I guess we don't have is the political will for these things.
Yes, that's exactly what is needed. And that's why we're trying to engage as many people as possible and to tell people about this this challenge, this moral challenge, because it's when people actually understand that there's a real problem and that even on an individual basis, each person can help, then they'll create a groundswell of opinion that their political leaders will start to pay attention to. And, you know, even with a great administration that we have now, you still have to hold your politicians' feet to the fire.
Absolutely, all the time. There is also the reality in the developing world that in many households in other cultures, the finances of men and women are not really pool to raise children. And I think maybe Americans might not realize that a lot of times. They assume that other people arrange their finances the way we do. But when men have money, the research shows that they often spend it on alcohol, tobacco, sugar, and other things, sort of short-term expenses that are fun, pleasurable. And when women have their own income that they control, they usually invest it in their children.
You know, that's very true, is that we don't think of it, but men and women, so research has shown, actually spend very differently as a whole. So research has been done on these people in the developing world are not that educated, but when a man controls the purse strings of the household versus a woman controlling the purse strings of a household, a man will actually have 20% of the income spent on things like tobacco and alcohol, cigarettes, sugary drinks or candy, and festivals and prostitution, whereas a woman will spend that 20% on other things like education, nutrition, and when she has scarce resources, she will invest in solid businesses. There are just distinct differences in the way women and men at that level spend. So if you can actually take some of that 20% that the man spends on alcohol, and even if it's 4 percentage points, and puts it towards education, you would get such a greater return.
Well, we're speaking with Cheryl Woudun, and she's one of the co-authors of a new book called Half the Sky about gender equality in the developing world and its importance. And we're going to go to line one. We have a caller from Urbana. Hello? Line one, are you there? Okay, let's go to line two. Are you there? Hello, line two.
Hello.
Hello. Did you have a question for...
This is something you probably mentioned, but I tuned in late, so I didn't hear the details. I want to bring up the whole issue of sex trafficking, which isn't only from the developing world, but it's also in the developed world in terms of the trafficking of women from Eastern Europe, from Southeast Asia, in Africa, or into both Western Europe, into the United States, into South America, and what can be done in the United States about that, because this is heavily tied up with drug trafficking, gun trafficking, and what we could call the terrorist networks. So I don't know how much you know about that, how much you're involved. There are movements in the United States to deal with that in the United States.
Absolutely. No, it is a terrible problem here in the U.S. too, and we do need to address it. This is not an either-or situation. We have to do both. The trafficking is very insidious, and it does happen in the U.S. The only thing I would say there is that, you know, when it happens in some of the developing countries, the order of magnitude of the brutality is just something that you just don't see here. You know, I've seen a girl who was forced into prostitution, and when she rebelled, they gouged out her eye. The brutality is just on the order of magnitude that you just wouldn't imagine here. But, yes, it goes on here, and it's terrible, and we need to address it at home, too.
Thanks very much for your call. Another topic that you do spend a lot of time on in the book, in addition to sex trafficking in the developing world, which the book certainly addresses, but another topic is maternal mortality. Women who die in childbirth, again, something that is very preventable. We have the expertise. It doesn't take tremendous technology, but a woman dies in childbirth every minute, and 99% of those women are in poor countries.
Absolutely. A lot of people don't know this, but when you say a woman dies every minute in this world from childbirth or in pregnancy, that's the equivalent to about five jumbo jets of women dying every single day. I mean, that's just an enormous number of women. You know, it's something that is totally preventable. We in the West don't think twice, you know, if a pregnant woman needs a cesarean, she'll get it. Well, a lot of women in the developing world don't have access to clinics. I don't know how many people know, though, in World War One, during World War One, in the U.S., more women died in childbirth and during pregnancy than men died in World War One. And we've turned that around, obviously. So this is entirely doable if there's a political will.
And you point out that maternal mortality went down in the United States around the same time that women got the vote.
Yes, it did because, again, it's the issue of political will. When women got the vote, it wasn't as though they voted on health care, but it was perceived by politicians that health care became very important, access to health care. And so it jumped to the top of the agenda.
It's shocking enough that a woman in Niger, for example, has a 1 in 7 lifetime risk of dying in childbirth. But there are also thousands and thousands of other women who don't die in childbirth, but who suffer significant injuries.
Yes. Niger is the worst place in the world for women who are going to give birth, but probably one of the most horrific injuries that girls can suffer is fistula. Obstetric fistula, and it occurs when a girl is basically too young to give birth. She just doesn't; her body is not mature enough, so her labor is obstructed, and the baby often usually dies. She also has tremendous damage to her insides, so that she becomes incontinent. She cannot control her wastes, and as a result, she basically smells. And she becomes worse than the lepers. They're worse than the lepers of society because there's not even a village that will accommodate them if they could go to one. So it is a terrible, terrible situation. But there are ways that we can deal with it, which is, you know, we have dealt with fistula. The U.S. had fistula among women before we recognized that this was a problem.
These women, you talk about the way they feel ashamed, they feel alone, they often contemplate suicide. Either they don't know that if they can get to a city and get surgery, this can be repaired, because it is not a terribly difficult surgical repair.
Oh, it's definitely something that we know how to deal with. But the problem in places like Africa is that there just aren't health clinics nearby that they can get to. There just isn't the network of health delivery. So we do need to build clinics, help local birth attendants create the circumstances so they don't get into obstructed labor. There are situations where the birth attendants don't even understand what has to be done, that they sometimes sit on the pregnant woman to try and force the baby out. I mean, the knowledge is just not there. But we do talk about situations in Half the Sky where, there's a situation with a girl, Mahabuba. She was 13 years old when she was raped, and then she tried to have the child on her own in the bush. And the child died, and she got a fistula. And the village was horrified by how she smelled. They put her at the edge of the village in a hut, and then they ripped off the door so that the hyenas would get her overnight.
Mm.
Well, this girl took a stick and basically fought off the hyenas that night. She was 14 years old, and the next day she crawled, dragged herself to the next village where she knew there was a missionary who then took her to a clinic, and she was repaired.
You tell this another remarkable story in this section about obstetric fistulas of Mamatou Gash, who is one of the top surgeons at the Addis Ababa Fistula Hospital, and yet for many, many years was completely illiterate, could not read or write her name.
Well, that's what's so remarkable about these girls. We think, oh, they're just uneducated girls. But you know something, talent is really universal. I mean, Mamatou is one situation where they actually were able to repair her fistula, and the hospital noticed that she was quite bright, but she had never gone to school. And so they started teaching her how to help as a nurse's aide, and then pretty soon she got so expert at that, they actually let her do some of the surgeries. And so she was able to do some of the surgeries. And then she got so embarrassed that here she was doing surgeries, but she didn't even know how to read or write. So she put herself in school. She started learning how to read or write. So these women are just very, very talented. And so we just need to give them a chance.
You also point out in the book, and so do some of the public health advocates who speak in the book, who work in this area, that midwives can be trained to do C-sections.
Yes, they can. It's not that you have to have doctors with MDs to do things like this. Certainly Mamatou shows that you actually can teach even an uneducated woman how to do a surgery. So certainly you can teach the birth attendants how to actually do the cesareans. One of the issues, though, is that you can teach health attendants to do this, or you can also work with the local birth attendants, because a lot of times they're actually propagating incorrect information. As I mentioned earlier, sometimes they'll sit on the woman when she's pregnant to try and force out the baby. Getting health attendants to actually train them to a level where they actually can perform the cesareans would be a huge boon.
This book is also a call to action. I mean, you don't want to just inform us. You don't want to just tell us stories about remarkable women. You want us to get involved.
Absolutely. I mean, we've written Half the Sky so that it's kind of like a do-it-yourself foreign aid toolkit, because we believe that every individual has the capacity to help someone overseas. I mean, whether it's, you know, helping a Cambodian girl stay in school another year because she's gotten $7 from an American to pay for her school supplies, or $30 just to buy a uniform. I mean, every individual can help, and if it's not money, then it could be their expertise. The you know, in the developing world, they just need so much expertise. They're just thirsty and hungry for it.
We've got a caller who wants to join us on line 4 from Effingham. Hello.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I'm immersed in the practice or the process by which patriarchy can be halted and reversed, and the matriarchy with maternal instincts can stop the madness that the world is now engulfed in. Somehow that's going to have to happen. We can't take the tools of patriarchy and somehow mold or try to refigure them into a society that is fair and non-sexist and sees to the true problems of humans on this earth and everything else for that matter. And have you ever given any thought to that, that somehow there has to be a reversal of paradigms if we're going to survive?
You know, I that's a very good question. I'm not sure that we need a total reversal, but we just need more benevolence. it is true that the patriarchal structure of the society creates a situation where even women are perpetrating some of these values, so that in the brothels you find a lot of the owners are women who are beating these girls who are forced into prostitution. So it is the patriarchal setup that really does create these systemic problems. But if it's not so much a reversal, at least if we educate people in a more enlightened way and focus their attention so that we can actually create opportunities for girls to go to school and for women to go into the labor force, that would actually do wonders. It's more just educating and changing people's cultural attitudes that's key.
There's also the point in the book about legal realities, and women have a very difficult time in many countries inheriting money and pensions from their husbands, inheriting land. Women own only 1% of the world's titled land. Our government, you point out, can pressure other governments to make these laws fairer toward women.
Absolutely. There are a lot of technical rules that just make it almost impossible for women to own property or to actually control finances. In some cases, women just aren't allowed to sign for anything, any kind of money, get a loan in their name. But that's very important, but more important is actually what it is in practice, because you could have all the best laws on the books, but in practice they won't be implemented. And so, in fact, it is more important to focus on the practice of things and to allow women to really, own land and to sign for loans. Some of the micro-lending is not regulated by the authorities in the same way that that real banks, financial institutions are, so that that's how they can get by if there are any rules that disallow women from actually taking out a micro loan, which is a tiny, tiny loan. So we ought to
explain a little bit more about microcredit, I think, and how women entrepreneurs in these areas often can't get just the small amount. Maybe they just need a couple of $100 to invest in livestock or inventory for a little store, buy a sewing machine. And you talk about how readers of the book and also listeners here could participate in a website like Kiva or Global Giving. You want to explain how that works?
Absolutely. Microlending has been a real phenomenon for women in a lot of the developing areas, particularly in Asia. And the way it works is it's called a microloan because it's a small amount of money, as small as $2, could be a couple hundred dollars as well. They're not at micro interest rates. They are at high interest rates, but they are at tiny amounts of money. And it turns out that when you actually give a micro loan to a woman, she tends to pay it back much more so than a man. So that's why they focused on women. She also tends to take that money and spend it on more solid businesses. So in many situations, and we talk about this in Half the Sky, you have women actually becoming the business breadwinners of the family, and one of the top earners in the entire village. So it really can change and transform a family and its village. So it is very important to focus on that. And Americans can do it very easily. I mean, Kiva.org, as you mentioned, is one site that actually allows you to, you know, make a microloan, and you get your money back because you're just lending to someone.
That's right. And then you get to pick somebody else. And
exactly.
and the process of choosing, my family participates in Kiva, and the process of choosing is so interesting. You learn so much when you see a little paragraph about each entrepreneur and what they're hoping to do, what they've done so far, and makes a wonderful gift for children, too, an account on Kiva to give out.
Absolutely. That's why we actually think it's such a nice idea, because people also educate themselves about the issues that are facing these women in the local countries. They find out what the needs are that women have when they want to try and start businesses, and, you know, just what the life around them is like, such that they actually, need to operate.
And you also point out that readers, the book has an appendix. There are lists of organizations that are local organizations led by local women leaders. And these organizations need support. They need resources.
Yes. Women's organizations have for a long time been sort of neglected in terms of the overall landscape of nonprofit organizations. But they do some excellent work on the ground in the developing world. And so we've actually provided a list that's just a starting point. I mean, it's not screened or anything, but we just wanted to throw out the names of nonprofits that people probably haven't heard about, names like CAMFED that educate girls in Africa, in many, many countries in Africa, and they've educated thousands of girls over the years and have done a wonderful job at just bringing girls along. And others like APNEAP, which really focus on education again in Pakistan. So, and also trying to bring women out of the brothels and put them into productive roles in society.
And is this information, or will it be available on the web? Is there a Half the Sky website?
Yes, there is halfthesky.org, halfthesky.org, that lists all of the websites.
Great.
Of the organizations that we list in the book. And there are a few more as well.
Okay. So halftheskymovement.org, and we'll put that on the WILL website as well in connection with this interview.
That's great, thanks.
Now, you also urge people to go to the developing world themselves and volunteer. This is not so easy and takes a certain amount of courage and organization.
It does, but you know something? The one thing that we've learned in doing the research for Half the Sky is that, on the one hand, foreign aid may have a mixed record on how successful it is in helping the people in the developing world, but you know, it has a great record in helping the givers, because you really get back so much when you give. There are very few things in life that actually can raise your level of happiness once you have all your basic necessities fulfilled. And one of them is contributing to a larger cause like this.
Well, I think that's a wonderful call. You make the analogy that you see this moral challenge very much like the abolition movement in Britain in the 19th century. British people didn't know about slavery. They didn't see it every day, so they really were not aware until abolitionists took it upon themselves to tell the stories, until freed slaves began to circulate through the country and lecture. And you say that this is similar. Sex trafficking is hidden to most Americans. Obstetric fistulas are hidden. The way militias use mass rape to terrorize populations is hidden from us. We don't see this, so we don't worry about it.
That's so true. You know, again, when slavery started, when it was even at its peak in the 1870s, it was basically an obscure topic. But then William Wilberforce started writing about it, started documenting. And the key thing is that he was focused on accuracy. He was focused on getting the facts out there, not exaggeration. And that's one thing we have to be careful about in this endeavor as well, is that not to exaggerate the brutalities. The brutalities are so horrific, you know, as they are, that they don't need to be exaggerated. So it's important to get the facts right. And the whole movement back then really happened because they were actually just spreading the message, and people saw how ugly it was and realized that they really wanted to do something about it. And so that's what we're hoping to do here.
You also point out in the book that psychological research has shown that if we cite all these statistics, this many thousands and hundred thousands of women and this every minute, that people, we all tend to sort of turn off. And when people heard about an individual girl who was dying of hunger, they gave more money than when they heard about, was it eight people? Or
yeah. It's a very interesting phenomenon. You know, corporations, when they sell toothpaste, they spend so much time, months, years, trying to study what is the best way to sell that toothpaste. We actually should take more care in trying to, you know, tell people about a cause or raise money for a cause. And there have been studies that show that when you actually are trying to evoke empathy or trying to, you know, draw people's attention to a particular issue, when you show a picture of a photo of one girl or one boy, you can raise a certain amount of awareness and empathy. As soon as you put a second picture, a second image of a girl or a boy in that photo, so that you're getting two, the amount of empathy drops off by nearly half. I mean,
it's extraordinary.
It's really quite important for nonprofits to understand as they embark on trying to spread their message and raise awareness.
And these stories in this book, I have to say, are very powerful. When you've met one woman who's in labor and can't get to a hospital and so on, it's an extraordinary experience to read about these women. We're running out of time, unfortunately, so I will have to recommend at this point to listeners to read Half the Sky for yourself. The women's stories are compelling, and the research and background information provides a context for the personal stories, and the sum is larger than any of the parts. Cheryl Wudun, thank you so much for your work on behalf of women, and thank you so much for being with us today on Focus 580.
Oh, thanks so much, Carol. It's a pleasure.